It's Wednesday, December 18th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 324 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 43 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
Alrighty, let's roll straight into it. So last time we talked about the social contracts that exist within a gaming group, specifically what we felt a game master did and did not owe his or her gaming group. This time I want to start talking about what I feel the players owe. And let's start by talking about what the players owe the game master. And I realize we're going to inevitably hit on some items that the player owes both the game master and other players. But as much as we can, we'll try and separate the two so there's some kind of order to this. Wayne, I'll start with you. What is something you feel that a player owes the game master?
First of all, I think everything can all be boiled down to one thing, but that would be a very short episode. Respect. So everything I have all falls under the category of respect. So the first thing that they owe the game master is a fair shot of playing the game. They owe the game master a chance to actually run the game without them trying to kill it, without them trying to sabotage it, or without them trying to break the game in any way.
Yes, they owe the game master the respect for the work, the effort, the art, the craft that he or she has brought.
And I would add the tone onto that.
And you're trying to run a serious game and it doesn't devolve into a comedy game. Somebody who doesn't want to play it intentionally starts playing a slapstick character just to be...
Or just as bad, you're running a comedy game and someone sets down and goes too dark. Intentionally.
Intentionally, yeah. Not the game organically goes
a
that way.
A slippery slope or something happening right. Is one thing. But when somebody sets down, knows the tone you're going for, knows the tone that everyone else at the table is going for, and intentionally goes completely 180 to that.
Yeah. Sabotage.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's keep digging through respect. Let's keep breaking it into its constituent parts here. I would say the next thing is they owe the game master respect for the game master's authority. Now, I don't think the game master is some demigod beyond question or anything like that. I think game masters can and should be challenged. But given the fact that the game master has to tell a story, has to maintain a setting, has to interpret the rules, there comes a point where the player needs to back off and accept, okay, the game master's made their call. I made my case on why I disagreed, but the game master's made his or her call. We need to accept this and move on.
The game master is a role at the table. They are fulfilling the role. You are empowering them to fulfill that role by sitting down and playing in that game.
Yeah.
You then are playing the role of a player, and you are empowered to be a player in that game. And like we talked about in the last episode, the game master has to respect your ability as a player as well. And I think that's a big part of that. One of the roles of the game master is to be the rules arbitrator, is to be the setting arbitrator. If the game master says something happens and you disagree, you've given them the ability to say that by playing in the game.
Chris, you're up.
I'm going to go with investment. Game master has created this world, has built this thing, is feeding you details here and there. Get into it. Respond to that. Immerse yourself in what's being given to you. You know, he built this world with or without your help. And now wants to get you into there. And he's trying to kind of set a scene for you. And it can't be done on its own. You have to dive in there and participate in that. It cannot be a one-sided thing. Related to that, players, if you're getting this stuff, go off and or go in and add some of your own details. Be an engineer of your own fate in a certain way and give the GM something to give back to you. You know, he's presenting you stuff with what he has there in front of him, but that doesn't mean that he's covered every single base.
Yeah.
And if you're going to go off on another angle, go for it. And if he's worth his salt, he will respond in kind and build that investment. And then it thus increases the enjoyment around the table.
Yes, I absolutely agree that one of the things, to phrase another way, that the players owe their game master is some amount of action. Whether that's proaction, reaction, or both. Chris, I think this falls right in with investment. When something happens, don't just sit there and stare.
So one of the ones I had is attention. Not just being invested in the game, but paying attention to it. Because if you're playing on your phone, and then it comes time for you to do something, you've just wasted the GM's time because they're now having to re-explain what just happened.
And the attention is where the clues come in. If you're paying attention, you're going to pick up the clues that are being, you know, put in front of you.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. If a player has been playing on their phone and not paying attention and then says something specifically about, you know, well, how were we supposed to figure that one out? I would have to bite my tongue because that would just set me off. If you've had all the clues in front of you, they were on the table, not on your phone. Should I have texted my plot to you? I can text my plot to you.
Put it on Tumblr, then I'll actually find it.
I'll work out the plot clues for you on Words with Friends. Here's one that, to me, is the most obvious one, and we haven't said it yet. The player owes a character.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is more than just having a character of some kind. I think the player owes the Game Master some real effort there. That, look, the Game Master has to develop an entire world, arbitrate and moderate what's going on everywhere, be everyone that you aren't. The least you can do is to sit down and to come up with a character that's deep, that's interesting, that fits well within the context of what the Game Master's trying to accomplish with the game, or what your group template says, or whatever. But the player owes the Game Master a character that is going to be an interesting part of this story.
I'll expand on that. The player owes the Game Master the knowledge of how to play that character mechanically. I'm not saying in the first session you have to know how your character works. I'm not saying if it's a one-shot you need to know how everything works. But if you're playing a campaign and the GM has to continually tell you how your basic skills work, that's just showing that you're not taking the time to learn it.
No, I absolutely agree. And as someone who was running a game for my family and friends group, where when we started, a lot of the people had never touched an RPG before in their life. There was a lot of learning curve there.
Yeah.
But you know what? They tried. They asked questions. They asked for clarification. They were asking me how I was arriving at numbers. And we got to a point where when I had to say something like, I need you to roll a 2-hit with a target of 18, they didn't have to ask me time and time and time again what that meant and how to arrive at that number. Yeah. They could look at their character sheet and tell me that.
And if it's a different question each time, that's one thing. Yeah. If it's the same question week after week, that's...
When I was running my Star Trek game for them, my youngest sister, she has to borrow the books from the FASA game. She went and photocopied all the rule books into a binder and read them all. Which, by the way, is a lot more than I was ever asking of her. I never asked anyone to do that. But the point is, she had that level of proaction that she was going to come in and she wanted to know something about it. And when she realized she didn't know a whole lot about the setting, she and her boyfriend, Doug, they sat down together and started watching through some of the different Star Trek series and movies and such. And they asked me, well, which ones would be most relevant to the kind of game you're running? So I gave them some recommendations. They sat down and watched those. They were invested in what was going on.
When we were doing Pathfinder Society with Sarah and I, she was getting really confused with some of the things for her character. And so we sat down and she came to me. It's like, I want to know what to roll. It's just, I look at the sheet and it makes no sense to me. And part of that was, it was one of the new character classes that wasn't part of the original core book. So we sat down and we made her a cheat sheet. And that's how she took the time to figure it out going in, so she wouldn't have to ask the person running each time. Because especially in that case, it's a different person running each time. But a cheat sheet, I think, is perfectly fine. If the character sheet isn't working for you, if it's, you know, something that's keeping you from learning your character, fine. Sit down, ask the GM, come up with something, a different way to present the same material where you can learn.
Well, and some systems have a cheat sheet on the character sheet.
Yeah.
What you can do is actually written out on the character sheet as part of.
I love it when I see a character sheet at a con and that's on there.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that just makes me happy. If I've never played a system and I look down and I can read the character sheet and find out what I can do, I love that.
We had a player whose cheat sheet was all the other players around him, because despite repeated attempts to, you know, edumacate him on the rules, he just never, ever got it. His response almost every single time it came to his turn in initiative when we were in some sort of combat or skill-related thing was, okay, so what do I got to do again? And he just, like, he never fully grasped it. And it was, you know, aggravating, of course, because you had to, again, address that same issue. Mm-hmm. But then again, this was also the same guy who, you know, going back to the tone thing we just talked about earlier, he was the guy who would play his character seriously, but he always gave him a comical name. So, whatever. You know, if he wasn't such a nice guy, we would have booted his ass from the group a long time ago. Not to mention the fact that we sometimes played at his house, so we kind of had to.
The last time I can remember somebody giving their character a comedic name, in what was supposed to be a serious game. It was Chad, but I can't hold this against them because this was during our spazzy teenage years. This was like right when we first started gaming. And he made a character whose name was Dick Johnson.
I've seen it happen on accident a few times that it kind of ends up funny because the person didn't intend it.
I'm sure you can, Chris, but go ahead.
Well, it was the same guy. Will was his name, but I mean, it was the player's name. But we were playing Deadlands, and he made a gunslinger in Deadlands, and his character's name was Idaho Penis. And he put the whole Southern drawl and everything on there as well. And all right, whatever you want, Will. So at that point, we had to kind of come to accept it, you know, so it was what it was, I guess. But
as a game master, I would have vetoed that.
You know, I've done the cheat sheet myself now that I think about it. For every time I do a Pathfinder character, one thing I struggle with is remembering all of the freaking feats. Because there are so many of them, and just the name of it doesn't always tell me what it does. And as much as I want the GM to remember things, I don't think the GM needs to remember what every single feat does either.
No, I won't.
So yeah.
Every character sheet I have has a second sheet that is a cheat sheet that is just the name of the feat and what it does.
The player owes the game master an understanding of the fact that they are not truly omniscient. Even though their role implies that they're allowed to behave as if they are. Look, if your character's thinking something, if you've got a power, an item they don't know about, freaking tell them.
Well, and that kind of leads into one of the other ones that I mentioned would be, you know, assistance. And that, you know, obviously the GM has to have a core understanding of the basic rules, mechanics of the games and how certain things go. But like we talked about in the previous episode, he is not going to know every single rule in that book. And this is where...
Well, I don't think it's just assistance with the game. I think it's also assistance with the table. For example, if you've got a player to the right that's struggling because they're not that outgoing, or maybe they're new to gaming, or they don't know how a rule works, you know, don't leave it for the game master. Or someone's unhappy because they're not getting enough spotlight. You know, there are things you as a player can do to kind of help the game master out and fix these problems, rather than just presupposing the game master automatically is aware of and has the bandwidth to fix all these things.
No, I agree. And that becomes critical, and because it increases the, you know, the enjoyment for everybody there, because players might be pulling in the more antisocial or reluctant players into the game, and not hosing the GM when perhaps the player has, you know, advanced rules knowledge over the GM. Being fair with that and that, but then that goes into a little bit of the whole trust issue as well. Trusting that your GM's not going to screw you over, even though you know you probably could screw him over.
Let me throw one out there. It plays right off that, Chris, and this is one that we also mentioned from the game master angle, but I believe the players owe the game master empathy. The same kind of consideration for, look, the game master may be having a bad day. The game master may have just screwed something up because they've got a lot going on in their mind. And so he or she didn't realize this plot inconsistency. You don't have to be a pack of wolves looking to attack your game master at every turn. You know, if they're having a bad night, don't pressure them to run a game. Give them the night off.
When you hear something just happen, don't say, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, if they're struggling with self-esteem, do what you can to help them out. If they're struggling to really get into the mood, like there's been a few nights where I've been game master and I come in and I've told the group flat out, I said, look, I need your guys' buy-in from the start because I had this happen and this happen and this happen. I'm really emotionally distracted. I'm feeling kind of worn out. I need you guys to give me the energy to game master this. And I didn't approach every game that way. I'm just saying I had nights like that because every human being does. If the players basically see this as an adversarial relationship, this is not going to work. You know,
it's funny. I have an anecdote about this one, Dan. I had something in the last run of the Dresden game that I introduced that everything about it would scream, this is a plot hole. And no one was picking up on it. And the whole time I kept thinking, are they just trying to be too empathetic and just letting it slide? Or have they really not gotten
no.
it? In the end, I found out they didn't catch it. It was the timeline of when certain events happened.
Oh, my players are usually much more merciless. at least in some... Now, you guys haven't been so much, but some of my previous groups, holy crap, they were merciless to me. No, and they weren't trying to be mean. But it did make my job very hard because I had to really dot every I, cross every T, mind every P and Q, whatever metaphor you want to throw in here. I had to do it because, man, these guys were vicious to me. But I think the example that probably comes to mind with the current group is the one that Chad and I talk about every so often of we're sitting up in a hilltop orphanage. And Chad says that you see torches below as one of my groups of gnolls comes approaching. And I'm like, gnolls have dark vision. He's like, and the torches make them visible to you. I said, great, they're carrying torches. It's just, you know, I'm not going to, I can chase this one around, or I can accept that what Chad's trying to accomplish and say, okay, they're carrying torches so they don't startle people. Whatever. If they see a caravan, they don't startle them this way because they're visible. So great. Who cares? Doesn't matter. It's not like blood in the water here.
So one thing I think the players owe the GM is if they know they're not going to be able to make it to a game, they owe notification as soon as they know that information. Not a text a few minutes beforehand when you knew on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Not an email that morning when you knew on Wednesday. If you know it, let them know. Not a big deal. Never a big deal if a player can't make it. But the sooner you can let the GM know that, the sooner they can adjust whatever they were going to have happen if they're a heavy planning GM. Well,
and let me embiggen that just a little bit and broaden that out to attendance in general. And this is one where I will happily admit, as a player, I presented some problems. It's kind of a long story why, and actually the only person I've really even told the full story to of what was going on was John. But the point being that I think if you are playing in a game, you owe it to the game master, number one, to at least make this some kind of a priority, to at least make every reasonable attempt to be there. Yes, real life comes first. Yes, it is just a game. But if you just blow off the game for anything and everything, you're ready to game, everybody's expecting you, and some guy calls him and says, hey, let's just go grab a beer. You know, nothing's going on. I just feel bored. And you ditch the game and run. That is disrespectful. You should have set that time aside. Try and be there. And Wayne, as you said, yeah, you may find out last minute you can't go because you're ready to walk out the door and all of a sudden, boom, food sickness hits you and you puke.
Yeah.
But if you know 2.5 weeks beforehand, 3 days beforehand that you can't go, you should communicate that to the GM as quickly as possible.
If you know before the session prior, even, you don't always know. A lot of times you don't know until the last minute. But if you know, and a lot of times that can lead to an interesting story.
Yeah.
The GM can work that in for your character to disappear during the course of that session.
Or figure something out. And I will fully admit that this is one where, as a player, this has probably been my biggest failing as a player over the past several years of my life. And it's been a relatively recent thing in terms of my gaming career, you know, past 3 or 4 years, maybe. But I will fully admit this is one that I have struggled with a lot. And I think it is important, is attendance and respect for when you can't make it, knowing that that's going to present an obstacle to the game master.
Actually, Dan, it's funny, that has been a problem for me as well, is that sometimes, just because my schedule always seems very fluid as far as the whole family life thing goes, I don't sometimes find out, you know, what's going on for me in the on the upcoming gaming day until a couple of days beforehand. And so, you know, I've tried over the years to try and fix that problem, but it is, you know, it's much easier said than done. And so I've been very guilty of that as well. But thankfully, it's nice having a forgiving group when it comes to that kind of thing. One other thing that I think players do owe the game master to a certain extent is, and it's funny because I actually, when I posted this on the Fear the Boot Facebook page, I kind of got some of the same answers back. If your group does food, players owe the game master a cut of that food. Again, to a certain extent. I mean, they don't necessarily need to feed the dude all the time, but the game master in a lot of ways is providing primary force of that evening's entertainment. You bring the guy a cut of your snacks or an extra, you know, pop if that's what you're drinking. It's a nice gesture to say thank you.
Could I reframe that a somewhat different way? Because I agree with you in principle, but I don't know that I agree with you in specifics. So let me explain it this way. It is absolutely true that in the average game, the game master will do a heck of a lot more work than the players will. Certainly any one player, depending on the type of game, possibly than all the players combined. I've seen a few rare occasions where that was not the case, but these were definitely the exceptions and not the rule. I think the players do owe the game master some kind of understanding for that effort given. Now, that could be cutting them some slack if they're a little late to the game or if they need to take a week off. That could be saying, hey, since you're pulling the load here, you know what? You don't have to worry about snacks. We'll take care of snacks. I'll buy your dinner. I don't know that I would want to set forth as a hard and fast rule that there is one thing in particular, such as food, that the players owe the game master. But I do think, as a courtesy, I mean, look, when anyone works really hard on anything for you, you know, I mean, it's just polite to do something to show your gratitude. And I would say, in principle, I think the players owe the Game Master that. I don't know that I'd want to say, well, they specifically owe the Game Master X, Y, and Z. But I would say, I think, at least in principle... Yeah, okay, yeah. Pat, sexual favors are theoretically on that list.
Yeah, because I don't want to get into just food, because, like, we do the communal food.
Yeah, you know, things like that. I was going to say, I could pull a police academy for you if you want to, but hey, whatever, you know. For those of you that actually get that reference.
I think it comes down for me is that no one person, regardless of role, owes the entire group everything. So you shouldn't have one person that provides location, game master, food, dice, rule books, paper.
Yeah.
No one person should be financially responsible for the entire experience of the whole group.
Yeah, people, this is a hobby. This is just like any other of your hobbies. For those of you that play golf or some other sport, you got to buy your own stuff. You get your supplies. You don't expect it to be just doled out to you by some persons. I mean, that's not common knowledge or just common sense. Then, well, it is now.
Well, that's
I've spoken.
That's the last thing I have really for the players owing the GM is the players owe the GM
a handy.
Well, they don't owe it. That's just nice to have. I mean, what if it's a female GM?
He was going the bribery angle. I was just completing what he was starting.
All right, so let's talk about what players owe other players. The first thing that came to my mind is, even when you have the ability to do so, don't hog the spotlight. And this is one that I messed up in that Dresden game. There are many factors that played into this. I don't feel solely responsible, but it happened. You know, I'm playing the dragon from the Jade Court. Suddenly we're in the Jade Court and the game's all about me. And I was not working as hard as I should have been to draw other people into that action or to say, you know what, Wayne, this was a bad idea on both our parts. Let's get out of the Jade Court. You know, let's wrap this up and go somewhere else.
But think about how many episodes we've got off of one mistake session.
Fear the Boot is a monument to our failures.
Learned so much. You learned so much. Yes. We have episode content. Right. That was a wonderful gaming session.
If we did not already have the tagline of an irreverent podcast about tabletop role-playing games a little bit more, or whatever exactly it is, I would totally have our tagline be a monument to our failures, because that's what this show is. But yeah, look, don't hog the spotlight. And sometimes people do this because the game is all about them. Sometimes it's because they're making it all about them. Sometimes it's because of the fact that they're just that socially extroverted. Mm. You know, and I'm not picking on the guy because it's just who he is. Chad can dominate a table. Mm-hmm. Okay, let that sink in, because I know this is going to shock a lot of people. There's a reason why I was doing a commentary on Facebook today where Facebook gave me my year in review and looked at my most commented on and liked posts or whatever. Like, here's the big events of your lives. And the first one was on January 6th. I posted, Chad just had to silence Beth because she was dominating him to the point he lost control of the game. And that is a feat. That was a feat.
Yeah, so. I remember reading that when you posted it. It's like, I don't remember that. I had to reread it two or three times. Did I read this right?
Yeah, Beth shut down Chad socially. That never happens. The point being, though, don't hog the spotlight.
Players owe a level of respect regarding their ideas. No player should ever turn to another player and say, that's stupid. That is a horrible, horrible suggestion. They owe them the respect that they would expect when they give out their own idea. And I don't mean their character has to agree with the idea or anything like that. I mean, each player owes the other player that level of respect to let them present the idea.
You know, I think you could actually broaden that one as well to say they owe the person respect for the person. Now, characters may not respect each other. That's right. Fine. But if I know that my actions are agitating Pat as a human being, this whole thing of, well, it's in character for me to do, that's crap. That is total crap. If your character is something that you know is actively upsetting a reasonable individual for reasonable reasons, okay, this is not just them being completely psycho. There's a really objective way you can look at this and say, yeah, a reasonable individual will be upset by this. You need to play a different damn character, or you need to revise how you're playing that character, or back off of whatever it is you're doing at the moment. You know, this comes, like, for example, in a game that, let's say, I'm playing. I know I would not like being stabbed in the back by one of the other characters. As a result, people have typically respected that. People, when they go to the game, say, you know what? My character is not going to betray Dan's character because Dan as a person would not deal well with that.
Everyone knows that I have a problem with animal violence. I can't imagine a single player at the table that knows me going out and attacking an animal in the course of a game.
And we've talked about this before, and it has just struck me because we're going at it from one aspect, from one player standpoint. Like, Dan, you were saying, if you were doing something that you knew agitated me as a person, you shouldn't do that. Well, the interesting thing about it is that the psychology of it is that you're doing it to me, and yet it may be agitating me as a person, but what we're forgetting is that it absolutely would agitate my character in the game, too. So my reaction to it as the person would be a legitimate reaction for the character as well. Wayne, if you're going to be a dick to my character, guess what? My character's going to be pissed off.
Yeah.
Okay? Just like I'm pissed off. So it's like, keep that in mind.
Right. I mean, I know too. A lot of people.
Don't just then fall back on the, oh, dude, I'm just playing in character. Well, guess what? So am I. You know what? So my reaction is in character too.
A lot of people really hate that phrase of, it's what my character would do. I personally don't have a problem with it. If someone says, it's what my character would do, and it comes up once, that's one thing. If that is a phrase, though, that is continued to be repeated by a player at a table, that player needs to stop and realize they're not being respectful of the other players at the table. If it happens once and everyone's like, dude, why did you just go slap the bear? Well, it's what my character would do. Okay. But if it happens every game and you continue to do things...
Let me meet you halfway, Wayne, in saying that I don't think it's about how often it occurs. I think it's about how it's used. Because I have played with people where they have something they want to do that is offensive, that is antisocial, that they know would upset somebody else, and they use it's what my character would do as a veil to hide behind.
I were using it, it would be the case of my character is doing this something that is not strategically advantageous to the group.
Precisely.
But it is in character. And that's why I don't like completely taking it off the board, because my characters don't always make the wisest choices.
Here's the thing about what Dan just said. I think this is key and a very important thing to learn about this. If you would encounter that in real life, where somebody, an acquaintance, a friend, or whatever, did something that was so antisocial and so offensive and so horrible, you would disassociate yourself with them and wouldn't, you know, around them again. The difference is in a game that you're playing, if you try to hide behind that and use that crutch and say, oh, I just want to do this, but it's what my character would do, and trying to pull off like, well, you know, you can't blame me and it's my character. Well, the problem is that in the frame of the game, it's like, well, we can't just like disassociate ourselves with you. You're part of the party. When in reality, the characters in the game should shun you and not play with you anymore.
Yeah, that is
to say, you're not in the group anymore. We do not want to associate with you. Leave. But then the problem is like, dude, that's my character. I can't leave.
That is
so
actually
think about it. Think about it before you act, people. Just think. Yes.
That's something I've wondered about, too. There's a lot of things that happen in games where if they happen in the real world, people just would not associate with that character anymore.
Exactly.
And I hear all of these gaming horror stories, and I'm left thinking, if you would continue role-playing that out the way it would actually happen, that wouldn't be a problem because that character wouldn't be with the group anymore.
I actually called Chad on this at one point because in the very beginnings of a game, he was making a character, and I don't remember the exact details of it, but he was making a character that he liked the idea of, and he had this idea of that he was basically, I think he was playing like a doppelganger of one of the of members of our party, that we're all close-knit friends, and what he was saying is that my character is actually an evil person that is shape-shifted into him, and so I'm playing that character, and in so doing, I killed the original character.
Yep,
and
it was a game we never actually ended up playing.
And he said that, and that is going to come out. And I literally turned to him and said, as soon as that comes out, my character will kill your character because that was my best friend. I said, that is how my character will react to it.
Oh.
And he was like, well, no, but I'm trying to redeem myself. And I'm trying to, my character will kill your character as soon as it comes out because you killed my best friend and took his place.
And I think,
and it's just like, you've got,
well, and this is, you know? This is where my point rests is that in character oftentimes becomes a veil that obscures the out of character.
Right.
You know, there's the issue here is an out of character one that Chad wants to play a redemption story. Well, out of character. Okay. Let's just presuppose he's not here. Yeah. So I'm just going to presuppose. And Pat, you want to play a game where there aren't these kinds of perverse betrayals and, you know, that kind of corruption, whatever you want to call it. Okay. Right. And the point being here, the in-character minutia of, well, my character this and my character that, it is really moving away from the real issue. Because the fact is that there are still ways that Chad would play a redemption story without having to play something that is about this gross violation of trust and ethics and all these other things.
Yeah, it's like
there are very few things in gaming at this point that when it comes up, I just say, let's not do that. Chad saying, I want to play a redemption arc is number one on that list because I have seen him attempt this so many times and he has always failed the redemption arc and it's never the fault of the game master or the game. It's always he wants to redeem the character, but when he's playing it, it gets worse and worse and worse.
I will say it. And because, again, I have no problem with redemption story. I think that's fine. It's completely valid. It's cool. And, you know, you can have a lot of fun with it, but what you have to realize is there are certain lines. Right. There are lines that you cannot close. It's social mores and whatever else like that that you just
let's keep the simple saying that one of the things players owe other players is to treat them with the respect you would a friend.
Yeah.
And the characters need to be subjugated to that framework, not the other way around. Mm. You know, I do not make
a character that intentionally will hate another character in the party.
Yeah. Or be hated by. Yeah. And I realize there's some careful lines you got to balance here.
There are ways you can do it.
You don't want to have this thing of, well, we've all got to be bestest friends and always agree and blah, 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 blah. But the point being that you have to show a basic respect for your friends.
Some conflict and some contention is good, but outright hatred.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Once again, unless it's the kind of game you're running, everybody's cool with that. But don't piss off your friends. All right. Let me move on to another one here of, I think players owe it to other players to balance themselves. Now, I talked about hogging the spotlight. Here I'm talking about hogging the power level. Mm. Some people know how to lawyer the rules or build that one magic item or stack these two effects or whatever the case is. They know the hole in the math and they can create a character in any game system that is so out of balance with the rest of the party. Or the game master maybe gives them something and did not realize when they gave it to him or her how it could be abused. Mm. And I think it is absolutely incumbent upon the players to recognize when they have come out of balance. They're so domineering the party that the rest of the party is just a rounding error in what's going on that they need to say, okay, guys, you know what? I'm going to back off. I'm going to cross some things off my list. I'm going to tone this down. I'm going to change up what I'm playing a little bit, play something else. I believe that players absolutely owe that to each other.
We hit on this one a few episodes ago, too, with a couple of anecdotes about, like, this is what a character does, but another character ends up having a better skill at it.
Mm, right.
Chad shared a story. I shared a story as well of just backing off your character because it's something your character can do and is really good at. But that's not the core of my character.
Because the other players are your friends. You want them to have fun. And they're not going to have fun if they never get to play.
Exactly.
Chris, you're about to say something?
What your specific example about allowing players to have certain things that you don't necessarily realize, were out of whack with the thing. I did that. I was guilty of that as a game master. And I wasn't necessarily sure at the time what was fully happening. But yeah, when it became evident what was going on, I didn't get called on it right away, and there were a couple things that I did make him kind of fix, but it didn't address a lot of the core problems in the campaign. But after the fact that it was done with, me and another player in that campaign were having a discussion about it, and he totally called me on it, the fact that I let him, A, not only do that, but get away with it. And yes, technically, I guess the other players should have brought something up, and even the player himself probably shouldn't have abused that privilege. But yeah, I was totally guilty of that. And it did. It did disrupt play, and it did tip that scale a little bit towards that PC when it came time for certain activities where he was actually, and this happened to be in a 3-0/3-5 game, he was a sorcerer and ended up being the best fighter in the party, within about a round or two. And it really kind of put things a little bit out of whack in regards to that. But I mean, I did own up to the fact that, I totally kind of screwed the
pooch
on that one.
You want to know what the dumbest thing I've ever done in the entirety of my game mastering history is? I gave Tim a ring of invisibility.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That's a mistake for anyone to do.
Period. All right. Here's the last one I've got. And obviously, you guys are free to throw out more.
I have a good one.
Here's the last one I've got. Players owe it to the other players to know their expectations for the game. When we're sitting there making the group template, one of the out-of-game questions that should be asked is, what is it you guys are trying to get out of this campaign? What do you want to get out of your character? And I ought to do what I can to not subvert or sabotage that. Mm.
For as an example, let's say Chad and I are both playing in a game, and what I want to get out of the game is the experience of being the charismatic character. So I build all of my stats around charisma. And Chad decides he's going to do something else. He makes a stats, has no stats in charisma. But just by the nature of Chad,
yeah,
he overpowers charisma. You know, that's what I wanted to get out of that gaming experience.
Yeah.
And he, as a player, should know that about me. And I, should, as a player, should know kind of what he's looking to get out of it.
And you should also express that. Well, let's emphasize here, no one's expecting a mind reader. Right. So we're
if I know Chad wants to go on a redemption arc, I shouldn't be doing things to actively prevent that from happening.
Right.
I've got a good one that actually came up in our game in the past, and we've talked about this a little bit, and I think this is a really good one. Something that players owe other players, especially when it's a newer player, is owe it to those other players to make their own mistakes.
Yep. Let them fail.
Let them fail and make their mistakes. And it's interesting. This has happened. It was interesting, the conversation, because Beth and I sort of realized that this is what we had done. We were talking after a game, and then we had talked to you later.
Because I've told you guys this since then.
And what it was is Sarah is a newer player, and she's never played a lot of things before. And in the game that we're playing right now, she's playing a paladin, never done it before, and things were happening. And again, just trying to be helpful. The rest of us players that are more veteran players on the table were trying to help in the fact of saying, you know, she would try to start to do something, would say, oh, no, you don't want to do that. That's going to be bad or whatever. And at the time, I really thought I'm being helpful. I'm helping because I played it. My first character's paladin, and I played it for like 10 years. And man, I know paladins, whatever. But what I realized after the fact was, wow, that was an incredible disservice to Sarah because she needs to make those mistakes. And I mean, because that's how you learn. Let her make mistakes. Let her fall down. Let her fail. That's how she's going to learn. Not by me telling her, oh, don't do that. Do this instead.
Playing with experienced gamers as my first gaming group is good in many ways, and it is bad in many ways. And it's one of the things I came up to you, and we talked about this after that conversation. A lot of things I've never experienced. Mm-hmm. You guys talk about all of these. You've went through all of these years of bad gaming to get to what you do now. I never experienced all that. I never had the dungeon crawls. I never had the...
Well, you had the advantage of coming into a group of gamers who'd already been doing it for years and had made all those mistakes.
Exactly. But yeah. I never experienced it for myself.
Right.
I don't logically know why those are mistakes. I just know they are.
Right.
Without having experienced it. And part of it is I want to experience some of that myself, but this group has already gone through it, so they're not going to want to go through that again. It's like, no. I've made those mistakes. Well, that's an experience that's now taken away from me that mm-hmm. I'll never have. So that's something I think in this particular example, you don't want to let the player get frustrated because they're just making mistake after mistake after mistake, but you don't want to handhold them too much either.
Yeah.
Just because you tell someone something's a mistake, that doesn't teach them why it was a mistake. They have to experience it firsthand to understand.
Sure, and there can be some consequence in there, but
you tend to also come off as... Potentially, to that player, you can come off as egotistical, right, yeah. as dismissive, like you're marginalizing the player mm-hmm. without even intending it. You come out thinking, I'm going to be incredibly helpful.
Right.
But that's not how it comes out. Every player owes every other player the right to fail on their own.
Yeah.
At least once.
On the flip side of that, what we were talking about is you should be helpful. Players should help other players, you know. You know about the system. If you've got that knowledge, it should be a knowledge share. You should be sort of a subject matter expert, so to speak, and help with that. But you've got to know the limits. You know, that's
and
the
it's
thing.
A fine line.
It is. You know, you have to be helpful, but not overpowering.
Players also owe other players the understanding that a bad night of rolls does not make a bad character or a bad player. A lot of times when someone, myself, rolls poorly, it's a streak. It's not just you, Wayne. Here's a one.
I've had some nights where I was so pissed off.
And it's something I've never experienced, but I've heard other people talk about. Everyone around the table understands I just roll bad. But I've seen, you know, in other groups and a lot of just listening to other actual plays and things, sometimes people will just assume, oh, that person doesn't know how to make a character.
That's if you do, then wow, that's horrible assumption on your part.
But also, when you're picking who's going to do something, that's something to keep in mind as well. People have off nights rolling dice, but that may still be what that character does.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen somebody project somebody's dice rolling back at the character. I've seen them certainly make, you know, funny little comments about it because mm-hmm. in the previous iteration of my group, Kevin, had your role in, like, maybe worse. I mean, this guy had an uncanny ability to take handfuls of D6s and roll nothing but ones and twos. I mean, it was mathematically mind-boggling. It's frustrating
because you know there's no such thing as luck, but it looks like there is because roll bad.
I've seen the rolling thing become part of a character's development. We had a person who's playing a Templar in Deadlands Hell on Earth, and these are sword-wielding, you know, justice bringers. And this guy had an uncanny ability when it came to hitting things to always get him in the head. And basically, it would be chopping his opponent's head off with that successful of a roll. And out of 10 rolls, he literally would get it about 50 to 60% of the time. And it became part of his character and who he was. Everybody, you know, kind of came to expect that, and it ended up becoming a reputation builder for. And that was just because the guy had these lucky rolls. He was just lucky enough to get that
stuff. Well, and I could see that because a character's history certainly does figure into the group's in-character perception of the character. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is I've never seen an in-character to out-of-character sort of spread where you say, Wayne's rolling like crap, therefore my Dan, not my character's opinion, but Dan's opinion is Wayne made a terrible character.
I think I think what it is people generalize it. They're not focusing on, oh, Wayne can't roll for crap. What they're seeing is, as a result of Wayne can't roll for crap, his character's ineffectual. In what he's trying to do.
All he's supposed to do is heal, and we're not getting healed.
Wayne is ineffectual. Yeah, that's a gross misinterpretation. Right. I can understand that. Because I feel when the dice luck goes against me, I get very upset. Because it hit me in the last game that we played, when it came to combat, I'm playing a ranger. I couldn't hit the side of a barn. Because when it would finally come up to my turn to, okay, roll your attack. Okay, I rolled a f***ing two. Yay. I'm like the best archer in this group and I can't hit it.
I heard an actual play once, a group really roll with it. And it was one guy just could not seem to roll to heal. He was a cleric.
Yeah.
And he could not seem to roll to heal the other character. So they worked it into their backstories and they started playing with it in there. I can't heal you because you don't believe in my God.
See, and that's fine. I think you can have fun rolling with that. Excuse the pun. And I've seen that happen where a character or a player rather rolls so well or so poorly, so consistently that you create an in-character perception that, wow, this person's really good or really bad at what they do. I just never seen that bounce back to an out-of-character perception that you have failed. Yeah. But anyway, here's the one I'm going to close out on. This is, to me, if you hear nothing else we say in the course of these episodes, hear this. What players owe to their fellow players is to never f***ing play Kender.
Yeah, you know, that is true.
So
that
even is very that true. Rolls up into my one answer for both of these episodes. What does the GM owe the player? What does the player owe the GM? What does the player owe the other player?
That's right.
Respect. You don't play a Kender because you respect.
That's correct. No one has been a Kender and respected anyone. So thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you guys are having a great holiday. I believe by the time this episode drops, we're probably be around Christmas, New Year. I don't know what. It's kind of some flexibility about where we might drop these episodes versus where we recorded them. But I hope you are having a great Christmas season or whatever holiday it is you celebrate. And you guys have a great games and all that stuff. And we will catch you next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.